as the two of them left. For some reason, they didn't want to leave the door open. And if there was anything in there that did any outgassing, that door from the internal pressure could become sealed. They'd never open it again, and they'd never come home. So there was a real nightmare about whether or not you should close the door all the way or jam something in it to make sure it can't close all the way. Because if that door jammed again, they'd be in a heap of trouble. Do you recognize any of that story of Paul WS2N, K2LAW?
You know, not to put that transcript in one of the, you know, actual things that were actually said on all these missions. And that's one of the things that Armstrong told Aldrin, you know, don't close the door. Something of that nature. But don't forget, don't close the door. You know. So, and they go out on, they used to call it platform out as they crawled out the porch. Wouldn't take much to reach in and pull that door into the closed position. So, yeah, a lot of things. There's some great stories. Some of the stories were told in Newsday today. If you read Newsday, they talked about a lot of the old timers that worked for the, you know, worked for Raman Building Lamp. And remember, it used to be called the Lunar Excursion Module, the LEM, they shortened it to LEM. But they, you know, they told up some of those stories, some of those people that are still involved with the cradle of aviation back then.
Now, I didn't see today's Newsday, so give me a couple of words on what did Newsday say. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I didn't finish reading all the stories. John had different stories from different people. But basically, you know, their ranges, a lot of them have, you know, gone dead, but some of them are still around, and they were actually working over the cradle of aviation, telling stories to anybody who wants to listen. You know, I read a couple of the stories. And, you know, they talk about you know, World War II, and some of them were around and working for Grumman before, way before the space program, and then they eventually evolved in, you know, in their work into something to do with LEM. So, I have to read it, Dick. It's pretty good.
So when Grumman finally won the contract to build the Lunar Excursion Module, as it was called in the beginning and later called Lunar Module, and obviously the landing was 1969, I'm guessing that contract began 1964, 1965. The beginning contract for
62, and then that paper.
Wow. 62. So 7 years of development took place for the Lunar Module. I'll bet you during that 7 years, a hell of a lot of modifications took place between the paperwork and what they finally really built. And on top of that, what's the total number of Lunar Modules that were built? And at least one extra one was built because it is sitting in the Cradle of Aviation Museum right now. And when you stand alongside of it and look at it, I don't know about you, but I am amazed how big that thing is. WS2N, K2LAW.
I remember reading about the span from the feet, one foot to the other, and it had 4 feet. If you measure it, I think it's 31 feet. That's big. And they had different iterations of the Lunar Module. You know, 11 and 12 was one type, and then forget about 13, and they used it as a lifeboat, but 14, 15, and 16 were an upgraded one. Carried more fuel. It had heavier weights on it, especially for 15, 16, and 17. Because of the rover that they brought up, and more of everything. They started staying 2 or 3 days long. So it needed to be be able to carry more weight, so the rocket was more powerful. How many different ones? Well, six landed on the moon. They're still there with the droppers. Well, let me put it this way. The landing part is there. The top part took off and went back to the dock with the Apollo command module. So, yeah, six were made. That actually landed on the moon. We had another one for Apollo 13. We know what happened to that one. So that's seven. The test one that Apollo 9 took around the orbit and around Earth. So that's eight. And then the other one that went around the moon. So that's nine. And then one in great aviation, 10. And I'm sure there's probably another one somewhere. You know, there's a mock-up one. I climbed on that one time. That was out in Calverton. That wasn't a real one, but it was as big as a real lunar module. Back to you, sir.
NASA canceled Apollo at Apollo 17. Wasn't there supposed to be an 18, 19, and 20 in the original plan, Paul? How many Apollo missions to the moon was originally planned? And as such, some number of those lunar modules were being built for those future missions. WS2N, K2I, that is.
Yeah, they had plans on building three more, and then eventually it would have kept going after that if the interest was there. But they were temporarily financed for those three, but then they scrapped those last three missions. In fact, they have a launch complex 39A, which launched all of these things. It was going to be a launch complex. They had a launch complex 39B, and that was for launching not the Saturn V, but the short version of it, Saturn 4B, which launched Apollo 7 and a couple of the test missions to orbit. Eventually, they used that for sending Apollo spacecraft up to there were three that went to Skylab. We dropped it. They have plans for a launch complex 39C, and they would have built another one of those complexes because they felt they were going to need all these complexes for the continuation of this lunar program that they thought was going to go on forever. So did I as a kid. I thought it was just going to keep going. But so 39C is land there. You could actually see a road going out to it. It flew over it. And they're going to use that for some future launches by a private company. I think Vector wants to do it. They'll make use of it. But yeah, there were big plans in the 1960s. You know, we should have had a moon base by now back in the day.
Yeah, in our youth, we all thought that we're going to be colonizing the moon as a stepping stone to further missions into space. And if you're naive, that sounds good. Until you start considering the huge amount of temperature extremes you get on one 28-day lunar day, 28 Earth days is one lunar day, you get huge, like plus 150 degrees centigrade, which is way beyond boiling water at high noon on the moon, and something like minus 250 degrees centigrade, which is way colder than any human being has ever survived, at lunar midnight. So the huge temperature extremes and the huge amount of consumables, oxygen, water, and food required to keep man alive in a high vacuum environment. And he's living either in a spacesuit, which is not pleasant beyond a day, let's say, and maybe he's not even pleasant for a day, and either that or living in some kind of a habitat. Let me drop this. And the only way that habitat can by those temperatures as if it is some significant number of meters below the surface of the moon. Well, hopefully the temperature is more steady down there. But how in the world do you establish that resonance? You have to do an awful lot of digging and constructing to construct that resonance below the surface. So it's a real difficulty. Colonizing the moon. The words roll off the tongue real easily. When European human beings colonized the United States, what became the United States, when you went there, you knew you were going to find sunlight, reasonable temperatures, rain, soil, plants, natives. There's a hell of a lot of things that's there that you take for granted. The moon has none of that. You can't grow food there. You have no air to breathe, except for some very specific places. You have no water. So to colonize the moon, what does the word colonize mean? And what's the major motivation for doing that? As a stepping stone to go to lunar orbit and gather your stuff and then go on from there makes a little bit more sense than going down to the lunar surface. Oh, you balls of yours, too, Ed. You have to negate some of my negativism here, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I know. Shackleton Crater, that's on the South Pole. Mostly daylight all the time. I mean, it's just angled in such a way that the sun hits that part almost all the time, so you won't have to worry about the nighttime problem that much. As if you could, you know, go to the equator. I think that's part of the answer for base number one. And they're all thinking about it, you know, European space agency, even Russia and China now, they're Japan. They all have long-term plans in here. And one of the places they want to go is the South Pole of the Moon. Lay out a whole bunch of solar panels. Mine some water, some ice that is down in Shackleton Crater. And this is where you have oxygen and helium. You'll be able to create fuel cells. These are the things they're thinking about. Nuclear power would be good, but that's not going to happen. Back to you.
When it comes to the distance the moon is from the sun and the earth is from the sun, they're almost the identical distance from the sun. They average the exact same distance. You know what temperatures we get at the North Pole and the South Pole of Earth. Can you imagine what temperature you get at the South Pole of the moon? That could easily be minus 150 degrees centigrade, Paul. Even though it gets partial sunlight for the whole lunar day, it's still going to be some ridiculously cold temperature. And the only way you can survive that cold temperature is to continuously be burning some kind of fuel that heats your habitat, heats your spacesuit. I don't think you can create a big enough heater in the spacesuit where the outside environment around that spacesuit is at minus 150 degrees centigrade. That might be the number of the South Pole. I don't think you can make a portable heater in a spacesuit that continuously can supply that amount of energy for more than an hour. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
I know they're always trying to get rid of the heat inside the spacesuit. They tend to overheat. In fact, they have cooling lines running through the body, through the undergarments. A bunch of tubing that's hooked up to an air conditioning system on their backpack. Seems to be a problem, not the heating part, they have heated with built in, you know, electric heat is in that system too. You've got them sort of running through the gloves now for your fingers. But, I don't know. It depends how long you're going to be out there. If you have enough solar panels laid out around Shackleton Crater, enough storage batteries to, you know, to handle whatever nighttime you do get, might be able to put some of the solar panels on part of the moon that will be in daylight, even though it's not in daylight at that time. And when you're in dark, those panels are still in daylight, and you can run the power to heat your habitat. But, you know, I mean, that's not the United States' goal right now. We plan on going to a thing called the Deep Space Gateway, orbital space station around the moon. That's our plan. But I don't know. I think they might have a shot at the Shackleton Crater.
Those cooling lines that are on the undergarment of an astronaut inside of a spacesuit, they're called cooling lines. It's really temperature stabilization lines. The front side of your spacesuit is being hit with solar energy, and except for the fact that it's painted bright white, it's going to go to a very high temperature. The back side of your spacesuit is looking at cold space at 3 degrees Kelvin, minus 270 degrees centigrade. So you're being baked in the front and frozen solid on the back. So those fluid lines are trying to stabilize the temperature between the front side and the back side of your body, so to speak. And sometimes the way you do the calculation, you end up with some extra heat, which is a big function of where on the moon you land and how long you stay there. Every one of those landings of Apollo on the moon's surface was a very carefully chosen place, somewhere near sunrise or somewhere near sunset, where you're halfway between those huge temperature extremes. And you can't stay there very long. If you're there for sunrise, you're eventually going to get way too hot in a couple of days, and vice versa, if you're there at sunset. So they're very carefully chosen places. Let me drop. Almost no American citizen knows about the temperature problem of the moon. They think if you had enough oxygen and fuel, they think the lunar module can sit there for 28 days if it wanted to with human beings on board. Not a chance in the world. You'd be cooking them well done at high noon and freezing them solid at midnight on the moon. No reasonable air conditioner can tolerate that amount of heat. No reasonable amount of thermal heater can tolerate that amount of cold. So, colonize the moon. And other than what they think is a stepping stone to further space missions, and those further space missions, like to Mars, for instance, have got some huge risks involved, huge expense involved, and to mine something on the moon, no matter what you find on the moon, let me drop it. The most valuable substances you and I can think of, gold, platinum, uranium, thorium, helium, no matter what. If the moon was made of the most valuable stuff you can think of, diamond, gold, uranium, so on, the amount of dollars it takes to get there and get it back would not be economically viable. So to do mining operations on the moon for profit, I don't think that's possible. So for a colony on the moon itself, if we, for the time being, jump away from stepping stone to further space missions, what do you get out of putting a colony on the moon, Paul? WS2N, K2IW, because each funding nation, there's going to have to be a multi-nation funding, is going to ask that question, what do I get for my money? WS4, K2IW.
Well, eventually they will be able to send valuable pieces of titanium and whatever they find there. there's aluminum there. And maybe not send it back to Earth, but maybe build other habitats or spacecraft for the future. You know, not right away. I mean, it might take you decades after colonizing the moon before you start producing things. But somewhere along the line, they might be able to do that. And, you know, could you imagine building a heavier spaceship out of something that never even left Earth? From stuff that was on the moon? You know, that type of thing could be done. 3D printing is big time thing now. So you could have 3D printers on the moon. You already got a 3D printer on the International Space Station. They've used that quite a few times already. So, I don't know. I think it's just going to evolve. I see it happening. When? I don't know. Right now, the next thing is deep space gateway, they're calling it, ESG. That'll be orbiting the moon, you know, for the United States. Whether other countries land on the moon first, probably, which is a shame. Unless the United States gets their act together. I just don't want to see other countries walking around on the moon, even if they're doing nothing, instead of us. That's what I really don't want to say. I said this probably 10, 15 years ago. But, you know, I was worried about China. You know, they have the 921 program. That's what they call it. Back in the 1990s, developing this whole space program. They want to build their own space station. Yeah, they're starting to do that. They want to go to the moon. They've already been to the moon with their rover. And then eventually send people to the moon. And I say, the last thing I want to see is, you know, the Chinese takanaks, they call them, walking around on the moon, charging up our batteries on the lunar rovers. We have three of them up there and driving them around. Back to you, the WS-1.
There is an Ansari Prize or something like that for a private, non-military, non-governmental organization to send a craft to the moon and do some amount of translating on the moon. That competition, what's the name of it? What's the deadline for that? How many people do we think are competing? When is that going to take place, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
W Toronto, Toronto.
I hear Toronto. It's the Google Prize. I talked about that before. That's the $20 million prize. I hear Canada up there. Back to you there.
Okay, so we only got a portion of that call letters. Toronto, Toronto. Give me the full call letters and your name and proceed with your question or comment, sir. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Oh, very good. We've talked before. It's Chairman Victor Echo 3, Juliet, India, Whiskey. Before I continue, is the signal okay?
Jim, from the Golden Horseshoe area, you sound good tonight. Victor Echo 3, Juliet Echo Whiskey, K2RIW. We heard you say Toronto, Toronto before. I guess you were telling us where you were from. You weren't trying to give us call letters with Tango Tango. Go right ahead, Jim. You sound beautiful.
Hey, good. It's Victor Echo 3, Juliet, India, Whiskey. Anyway, I was listening to your keeping a spacesuit spot. I can see if I was in minus 53 with an atmosphere around me, I would have atmosphere, so I'm very dependent on the insulation in my spacesuit. But if I don't have any atmosphere around me, how is that coal actually going to remove energy from my spacesuit? If I'm not, I'm giving out infrared and radiate some, but I don't have a cold atmosphere against it and trying to warm. I just thought I'd throw that in when you were talking about how much heat it would take to keep the space is running. Thank you, RIWVE3JIW.
Yeah, Don, good question. Jim, Juliet, India Whiskey. Heat is transferred by three procedures: conduction, convection, and radiation. So if you're in a spacesuit floating freely in space, there is no conduction. There is no external convection, but there is radiation. Story Musgrove, during the repair of the Hubble Space Telescope, was out there for 8 or 10 solid hours. And he's in orbit around the Earth every 90 minutes. So for 45 minutes, he's in the sunlight, and 45 minutes, he's in the dark. During the time of the 45 minutes in the dark, his gloves got so cold that he essentially got frostbite in his fingertips. I was at a lecture and saw Story Musgrove face to face at the Cradle of Aviation Museum on Long Island when he was giving a lecture for the Astronomical Society of Long Island. This was about 5 years ago. And he has no feeling in his fingertips anymore because of that repair mission of the Hubble Space Telescope. So 45 minutes of non-sunlight created intense cold of his hands. You and I get exposed to conduction and convection, and they dominate. But when you're in free space, that radiation, although it's a smaller factor, still, the backside of your suit, which is facing cold space, let me drop this. The backside of your suit, which is facing cold space, and cold space is less than 3 kelvins, minus 287 degrees centigrade. That's the temperature the backside of your suit wants to go to by the radiation process. The front side of your suit is being hit with sunlight at 1,300 watts per square meter. It wants to go to some ridiculously high temperature. So thermal equilibrium in space is a difficult thing to come up with. Each of the satellites that we launch, you have to very carefully paint them with the right kind of paint so that they come up with the right temperature and rotate them in the rotisserie mode. During the time that the Apollo missions went between Earth and Moon, let me drop this. That spacecraft was in a continuous slow roll, the rotisserie mode, as they called it, in order to equalize temperature. The hardware on board would not be able to tolerate, if I understand correctly, a significant amount of time of the command service module not rotating. If you fixed it with no rotation and allowed the near side of the sun to get hot and the backside to get cold, I don't think the equipment on board could tolerate that. Let's see what the Pauls have to say about that. I think they have to continuously use the rotisserie mode. WS2N, K2LIW, go ahead, Paul.
I don't know if they were worried about electronic failures. They were worried about expansion and contraction. They didn't want one side of the spacecraft to expand too far and the other side to contract. That would have changed things. It would have put undue stresses on the vehicle. So, that I've heard that kind of accident.
Now, when you're on the moon, and if you were standing on the lunar surface at high noon, where the lunar surface goes to 150 degrees centigrade, and you're in your spacesuit, and one complete hemisphere of what your spacesuit sees is moon, and one complete hemisphere is sky, and that sky is aimed toward the sun, and the hemisphere that's aimed toward the moon at 150 degrees centigrade, it wants to heat up the back of your suit to 150 degrees centigrade. It's a slightly slow heating process, but that's the temperature it wants to go to. And there are means by which you and I could calculate how many BTU of cooling is required on the backside and how many BTU of heating is required on the front side when you're not aimed toward the sun. And so, I'm pretty sure that with such extreme temperature numbers, I mean, can you imagine taking that very thin glove and touching lunar soil at 150 degrees centigrade? DE3JIW, K2RIW, go ahead, Jim.
Yes, okay, here's an interesting thing, though. If you're, I've been minus 43 weather, 200 miles north, it was super cold, but I've been around minus 20 often. If you have low humidity, it's not brutal. If you're in an area with high humidity and that temperature, it's nasty. And I believe it's the amount of energy that it comes to absorb from your skin. Minus 20 without wind and away from a great lake which has moisture. Minus 20. Minus 20 is brutal, but it's brutal in a high humidity area like Toronto where the lake is frozen but it gets cold occasionally. Realize we're not that far north. We're only 43 and a half. But anyway, the problem about the heat is how much can you radiate away if you don't have an atmosphere that you're trying to warm? We don't have figures tonight, but that was my only thing, that I know that the cold when the humidity is not high is not nasty. That connects to you, all right?
When you were near a lake at minus 40 or so degrees centigrade, which is granted minus 40 Fahrenheit, any wind blowing off that lake is going to be very significant to you. You felt that the humidity being high made it more brutal. If the outside air temperature is minus 40, what in the world could the dew temperature be? The dew temperature is minus 41. The total amount of moisture that's in air at minus 41 degrees centigrade, if it's saturated, is an extremely small number. So, you guys may pass words back and forth and think it's humidity. I think it's the wind. Although it's an exaggeration, the rule that they use in the Antarctic is the minus 30-30-30 rule, we call it. And a 30-knot wind of minus 30 degrees centigrade exposed flesh freezes solid in 30 seconds. It's an exaggeration, but it gets the point across. With a 30-knot wind at minus 30 degrees centigrade, if your skin is exposed, within a minute, you're in a hell of a lot of trouble. DE3JIW, K2RIW on the TechNet.
You're going to lose the repeater soon, Dick.
Roger.
This is the time I should let you take it away, and we can pick this up at the night. I love the fact that you listen on the internet. 7-3, guys.
You sound good, Jim, and check in more often. This was TechNet number 1659. That was Space Report number 259. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. And I guess we should be thinking about space. The final frontier. K2RIW, clear, been listening. Over to you, Paul, if you want to put any finals on this. WS2N for any finals. Final, K2RIW. Bye-bye.
Okay, Dick. Good night. And the next possible land launch that I'll be interested in is the manned launch from Kazakhstan. The Russians are going to launch it. Three people, one for the European Space Station, Space Agency, the Russian commander, and there'll be an American on board as well, Randy Bresnik. And that'll be the 28th of July, coming up in a couple of weeks. That'll bring the crew of three back up to six on the space station. 73 will be back next week.
WS2N clear. K2RWW2RY. Can you talk okay on 37 if this thing gets shut off?
Sometimes I can. I'm going to give it a try. Bye-bye.
147375. Can you hear me okay?
K2RIW. A very noisy K2RIW. Yes, I'm hearing you very well. Go ahead.
Okay, just in case. Then I know the other thing is cut off of, you know, it might cut you off minimal sentence there. You were talking about tubes earlier today, and you had visions of building a higher power amplifier for 432. Would the tube I mentioned be a better tube for that frequency band, a 4CX300A? Would that be a better tube? I have a reason for asking you this question.
I've got a guess as to why you're asking that. And it's a very desirable sound. It's a very desirable sound. I'll see if I can move my antenna and improve this a little bit. I've got to plug in the rotator.
Visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2BL repeater.